Live from the Allstate Showcase Studio. This is the Steve Cochran Show on Chicago's very own 720 WGN.
Need to make it out of a chair. Oh, 609, welcome to the Allstate Showcase Studio. It's the Steve Cochran Show. Number 857. Chuck Todd this morning. A lot of politics to talk about as well. Coach Q later. And man, what a 9 o'clock hour. We got Bill Rancic. We love Bill. Mm-hmm. Don't you love Bill?
I love Bill, and I love Mama DePandy's meatballs, too.
If Bill offered to dump Juliana and run away with you, would you do it today?
No, I like Juliana.
Come on.
She's a nice friend.
Well, maybe they're having trouble.
They are?
No.
No, we love Bill. Bill's a Southside guy.
Happy.
Love Bill.
And then your good friend, the Barefoot Contessa.
Yeah, Sandberg and I are very psyched about this.
Be on at 9:20. You guys will be doing that interview.
She's got a show in Rosemont tonight.
A show? What is a show?
It's a show. She does like a cooking demonstration and then a Q&A. She is hugely popular.
Yeah,
I didn't even realize how.
I knew that, but I've literally never watched a show with her.
She's so sweet, and she's so, right, Mary? She's just so approachable. And the cutest thing is she cooks mainly, she has her house in the Hamptons, and she cooks for her husband, Jeffrey. And she has like 3 degrees. She used to work for the government. She was like a...
Isn't it kind of sick and twisted that we just watch her cook for Jeffrey?
It's so cute.
No, sometimes she has some friends. She has a florist friend. He always brings over flowers.
Yeah.
A couple other people.
It's just a happy time.
You guys don't find it weird? You're just watching somebody cook dinner for friends and family?
You know what's cool about her, right? She's just normal.
Why is she called the Barefoot Contessa?
I don't know. I want to ask her
that. I think it was her first store.
Oh, was it?
I recall, yeah.
Yeah, literally, she's got like 2 degrees.
I made her seafood gratin for dinner on Christmas.
Did you?
Yeah.
Oh, was it good?
It was amazing. I've made it before. I love watching people cook.
I do, too.
Because it gives me ideas.
She's the number two. I think it used to be Rachel Ray, but now it's Bobby Flay, and then Ina Garten is number two.
Oh, I love Bobby Flay.
As far as like top, you know, chefs with the highest approval ratings.
Mark Carmen's here for Anna. Do you watch any Food Network?
I used to when I...
I don't watch any of it. You know what I do? I eat.
Yep, eating's good, Steve.
You know what I think for you? It's kind of relaxing. It's nice to watch somebody else cook.
If I'm any more relaxed, I'll be asleep.
You know what?
That happens.
You know how you watch all the politics stuff?
Yeah,
And you feel, after? When you watch the cooking shows, like, you feel, hungry.
Yeah.
And
it's a happy time.
Chopped is good, Steve.
Oh, we love watching Chopped.
Yeah, Chopped is good.
So the Food Network's good for denial?
Yeah, it's an escape.
You know,
and then there's like...
what am I using the Golf Channel for?
Yeah, you can do that too.
That's true too.
But sometimes Golf Central reruns, and so like you need a fresh show. So
yes.
Go over to Beat Bobby Flay and you're...
You know what you would like?
Bobby Flay used to come in the studio all the time.
Oh, I love Bobby Flay.
He used to come in. He was in here every 3 or 4 months.
I'd run away.
What happened
with Bobby
to Bobby Flay?
I don't know. He's adorable.
What happened
you don't
to
want
him?
To run, you don't want to run away with Bobby Flay. He's fooling around with every woman in America.
He has a girlfriend now.
Oh, yeah, it's cute.
Is it Jada?
No. No, she's not a cooking girl. She's an actress.
And I'm
York
sure,
is the last name.
I'm sure this, one,
on
this one will last forever.
I think so. And he's got a new cat, Nacho Flay. They were just on CBS Sunday Morning.
Oh, if he's got a cat, then he's definitely not cheating on her.
Nacho Flay.
He's an only child, and he grew up with cats, and those are his siblings. The piece on CBS Sunday Morning, you should look it up. It was really good.
I probably won't. That's Barefoot Contessa this morning at 9:20. And then my friend Dave Barry. Dave, there's nobody funnier than Dave Barry, including me. Dave Barry and Alan Zweibel, who used to write for Saturday Night Live and everybody else about it. They'll be on at 9:40. They're good friends, and they've written a new book together with a third gentleman who you don't know, who won't be on. But Zweibel and Barry will be on today, and they're funny, and they're goofballs. So we got a big 9 o'clock hour for you, and that'll be on CLTV as well. Mm-hmm. Every 9 o'clock hour is on CLTV, so you can watch it there. And then 3 o'clock, Ro and Anna are on CLTV as well. But, you know, anytime, all morning long, you want to pop it on, looking at your iPad situation, you go to WGNRadio.com, you click watch, and there we are.
In our glory.
Now, the lights are off now, so it might be a little hard to see. But
it's early.
I do something that annoys the staff greatly. Well, it doesn't annoy you, I don't think.
I like the lights down.
I don't like waking up to bright lights. Mm-hmm. So if the bright lights, the studio lights are on when I walk in, my head explodes. So I insist the lights be off at the beginning of the show. And then as the sun rises over Lake Michigan, the lights can be turned on as needed.
Do you know what? I know daylight saving time is this weekend, but it's starting to get a little bit lighter now when we're waking up.
We get so screwed, though, on that. We do. Because June 21st, I believe, is the longest day of the year. And the sun sets at like 8:30.
Yeah.
There's other parts of the country where it's light till 10 o'clock at night.
Yeah, like Iceland. Places.
Well,
like
Iceland, that's 24 hours.
I know.
But
depending on which season.
Minneapolis. When I lived in Minneapolis, it was light till 10 o'clock at night. We're too close to the timeline, right? Is that the deal? I think that's it.
Should we move?
Move Chicago. And let's bring the lake.
You know, sometimes in the morning, it's so dark down there, I can't even see either of you in the cameras.
Oh, that's our game.
So you can't see the faces we're making or the hand gestures?
Nope. Or food that you might have down there.
Oh, yeah.
We never hide the food from you. You're like a Labrador Retriever. You'll find it. all right, 6:15. We'll come back to the top six at 6 quickly in just a second. Or you want to do it right now? Want to do it right now? All right, crank it up.
Now it's time to move on to a little something we call...
The Steve Cochran Show presents the top six at 6.
That's the best number I've heard yet.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5.
Yes.
6.
Lucky guess.
My favorite number is 6.
The top six at 6 on 720 WGN.
The CIA WikiLeaks leak is really, really bad, according to Senator John McCain. And as they reveal more and more, it seems to be getting worse. WikiLeaks people, who now apparently are working for Russia, say that this is only 10% of what they have. Not good. The CIA also believes it's an inside job. I think they got a mole. Wasn't Anderson Cooper the host of The Mole for a while?
He was.
Maybe Anderson Cooper's the mole. So the CIA believes it was an inside job somehow tied to WikiLeaks, and they're looking for the person inside. And that's the premise of the ABC show, right? Mm-hmm. The Quantico thing?
Yep.
Isn't it all coming back to TV? Next! How do you miss a giant fault line in California? I don't know how this even happens, but apparently there's a new fault line discovered by seismologists in California that they say is the source of the next great earthquake. They said when the next great, giant, epic, mega quake happens, and if you look at a map, you know, California's got the, you know, the shape of the state. Mm-hmm. When it breaks off like on a dotted line and California floats out into the Pacific, it'll be that fault line.
Yeah, they've been saying that's going to happen for years.
But the New Madrid fault here in the Midwest still remains the biggest fault in the country.
That's not our fault.
It's not our fault. Well, it is our fault, actually. It's here. But the New Madrid fault, who hasn't had a quake, an epic quake in, what, 150 years?
It's been active,
scared.
But not bad, not badly.
How do you prepare for that, Steve? You got any advice there?
Yeah, just wait.
Run.
Just chill.
Just wait. Yep. Next. John Huntsman, the former presidential candidate and the father of hot daughters on various television stations. John Huntsman is now about to be named the new ambassador to Russia, which is probably not a bad idea. So he'll be the guy that goes in and probably will be slapped with bugs immediately when he gets into the country.
Have vodka with Vlad.
Vodka, next! There's an Illinois bill being proposed. I don't see this getting anywhere, but they're asking for a younger drinking age with parental permission. Is this some 18-year-old legislator? Why is this a bill?
I don't know. There is no drinking age in Europe, so maybe they're trying to...
But what is the need for this?
I don't know. There shouldn't be. But.
And finally, Tim Tebow played for the Mets yesterday really, really bad. Let's go live to the Mets spring training camp. Here's Mark Carmen.
Tim Tebow at the plate. Tim Tebow with an 0-2 count. Tim Tebow fastball down the middle. Tim Tebow looking strike 3.
Not so great in the field either.
He DH'd. I didn't see. Did he have?
Oh, did he DH?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Not a good day for Tim Tebow. Poor Tim Tebow. It's 6:18. We're back with Nick DiGilio. Previews and weekend movies next on 720 WGN.
What to see? What's out at the show? I need to know the place and when. But there's one guy on GN's Cochran Show, and what he says will make us stay or go. He is Nick at 9. Dr. Julio, he knows what shows are good, what's stinking. He's the only one who's in the know. I need to know what Nick is thinking.
Have you made that your ringtone?
I need to know what Nick is thinking.
My ringtone?
Yeah, have you made that your ringtone?
Oh, sure.
The theme, the Nick theme?
Yeah. It's my ringtone. It plays whenever I open my front door.
Oh, that makes sense. Sure.
When I flush the toilet.
Oh, when you flush the toilet. Perfectly timed. How are you, man?
Good. How are you, man?
I'm doing just fine. I got a new King Kong movie coming out. How many have there been?
Wow. Geez, that's a good question. There have been, I don't know, maybe 20, 25 of them.
And
over
what?
Over the years, you know, and I would include Mighty Joe Young in the remake in there, too.
And what is your favorite?
Oh, the original. The 1933 King Kong is one of the greatest movies ever made. And to this day, when you watch that movie, I can't imagine what it was like to see that movie on the big screen in 1933, because it literally had been nothing like it before that. I mean, if you think, you know, maybe you were like 14, 13 years old when you saw Raiders of the Lost Ark for the first time and it blew your mind. Multiply that by 1,000 if you're like a kid in 1933 and you see that movie on the big screen.
How did they do
up to this day?
How did they do the special effects then?
There's a lot of stop motion animation. It was in the same way that they like the Leica company does, you know, Kubo and the Two Strings. It was all little figures that were put together, and then there were, you know, they did very, very, like, some of the first ever matte paintings where you would superimpose the characters over what looks like a jungle but really isn't. It was, at that time in 1933, state-of-the-art, beyond state-of-the-art. And, you know, I screened it at my film club 2 years ago, the original 33 King Kong, and seeing it on the big screen is just as magnificent as seeing the Peter Jackson remake from 2005, which I also love. I love all giant monster movies. I just, you know, I grew up watching all the Godzilla movies, and I've already got my tickets for Saturday IMAX 3D. For the Skull Island movie. I'm unbelievably excited about it.
What about
I was going to say Beauty and the Beast.
What about the classic movie Row, where Row Khan stomps into Chicago and takes over?
Yeah, that's and when he climbed the Tribune building.
Yeah.
It was fantastic.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm,
yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, very scary. All right, so is this the one with Samuel L. Jackson?
Samuel Jackson is in it. John Goodman is in it. Brie Larson is in it. Tom Hiddleston is in it. John C. Reilly. And so on top of, you know, an awesome ass-kicking giant ape and dinosaurs and giant monsters and giant spiders.
Mother effer, get off that building!
Well, this is a PG-13, so he's not going to be able to say that.
Okay.
But I mean, it's an incredible cast as well. And, you know, the trailers look amazing, and the early reviews are great. I've been waiting for this movie since I saw the trailers last year. And like I said, I got my tickets already. My folks and I are going. It's going to be an IMAX 3D. It's going to be loud and crazy, and my dad will say, "Oh, I won't have a problem hearing this."
I love the fact that you take your parents to a movie almost every week, right?
It is every week, every Saturday. Yeah, yeah.
That's
I usually see one or two on Friday on my own, and then we go every Saturday. And I got to tell you, my dad's favorite movie this whole year so far, where like he's been bothering people, like strangers, and tapping them on the shoulder, and bothering people while he works at Jewel. And he screams the praises of Get Out.
Oh, that's cool.
But my dad, he went nuts over that movie. He went nuts over it.
Well, it's one of your favorites too, right?
It is one of the, I mean, you know, I got to tell you, this has been a strong year so far. Between John Wick and Get Out and Logan from last week, which is the best comic book movie I've ever seen, ever. It's been a strong, strong year so far, and I've got very high expectations for the Kong movie, so 2017 is starting off with a bang, I got to tell you.
So is this driving more people to the theaters, or is Netflix still where everybody's going?
You know, I mean, for the big stuff, you know, like, you don't want to see, you know, I mean, like the Kong, I think the Kong movie is going to make a ton of money this weekend because simply this is not a movie that you want to watch on Netflix or your tablet or whatever. You know, this is a movie that you want to experience big. Logan is the same way. You know, Logan made a ton of money over the weekend and made over $85 million over the weekend, and it'll continue to make a lot of money this weekend as well because of the quality of the movie, which is, you know, a lot of people are going out to see that. But the big success story is Get Out. Get Out has made over $78 million in 2 weeks. It cost $4 million to make.
Wow. Well, that's great because that means what's-his-name is going to get free reign to make a bunch more.
Absolutely right. Jordan Peele is going to have his, you know, he can do what he wants. It's very interesting because horror movies, if they do well the opening weekend, they usually drop really big the second weekend because, you know, horror is such a specific genre and all the horror fans will go out the opening weekend and then it usually drops most of the time 40 to 60%. It'll drop from the opening weekend to the second weekend. Get Out only dropped 12%.
Wow.
Yeah, so people are going to see it, and they're having a great time, and Logan is a great movie, it's a comic book movie, but it's way beyond what a comic book movie should be, and I'm not kidding. At the end of the year, don't be surprised if Hugh Jackman and Patrick Stewart are up for some serious Oscar consideration because it's that good and they're that good in it.
Well, I just think it's impressive to take a vehicle like that that have, what, 11 movies in, is that right? And
10 movies.
To come up with an original take on it?
Years. Yeah, he's played the part in 10 movies for 17 years.
Yeah, pretty impressive.
And what they did with this movie, it's incredible and a great way to end his run as Wolverine. This is the last Wolverine movie that Hugh Jackman will ever make. And it is the crowning achievement of 17 years, with that, without question.
Yeah, and by the way, the reason is, and I don't want to spoil it, but Hugh Jackman and Kiefer Sutherland from 24 go off and they open a hamburger joint together. That's why
he
doesn't make any more movies with the 24 thing.
Is Chloe involved?
You know.
Yeah. So watch Kong on a big screen, but if Kong ever does like a remake of Sleepless in Seattle, it's okay to watch it on an iPad.
Yeah, that's what I would say. Yeah,
Kong does a romantic comedy.
I could say. Well, I actually think King Kong is a very romantic movie. Beauty, it's one of the most beautiful lines at the end of the movie. It was beauty that killed the beast. That's just a legendary line in film history. One of the best ever.
Kong loved her.
Kong loved Faye Ray.
Doesn't every woman want to be held in the palm of a giant hairy creature?
Absolutely.
No.
All right, plug for your upcoming Hitchcock movie, Tuesday night, April 11th at Movie Cove Theater in Rosemont. Get your tickets for Rear Window.
Rear Window, one of the best movies ever made, and my second favorite Hitchcock movie after Vertigo. And it's just, if you've never seen it, Jimmy Stewart, Grace Kelly, Raymond Burr, just classic, beautiful Technicolor, and it's going to be digitally remastered. It's just going to be great. It's Tuesday, April 11th. Tickets are on sale right now. We put them on sale yesterday. And if you want to go, you go to Fandango.com. And it's Tuesday, April 11th, $10. Parking is free. And you can go to Fandango.com for Rear Window on the big screen. And I want to thank everybody. We had a huge turnout for Reservoir Dogs last Tuesday, man. A really huge turnout. And I just want to quickly say that my mom completely freaked out during the ear cutting scene.
Well, of course she did. She's your mom.
Yeah. Yeah, she freaked out, and now she'll never hear Stuck in the Middle with You the same ever again.
Oh, poor Jerry Rafferty.
Yes.
All right, buddy, thank you.
Sure, man.
Nick DiGilio, 2 to 5 a.m. every single day, weekdays, here on 720 WGN. Big story next.
This is the Steve Cochran Show.
And the president said, quote, "I love WikiLeaks." Does he still feel that way today?
There is a big difference between disclosing John Podesta's Gmail accounts about a back and forth and his undermining of Hillary Clinton and his thoughts on her on a personal nature and the leaking of classified information. There is a massive, massive difference between those two things. And I think it is, again, the interest and the outrage that occurred last year by a lot of Democrats when it came to leaks is interesting that we're hearing not as much outrage now when it comes to some of our issues of national security.
WikiLeaks! I love WikiLeaks!
He actually stood up in front of a room of reporters and said that yesterday. It's okay if we do it. It's not okay if they do it.
How does Sean Spicer look himself in the mirror?
What do you people not understand? It's okay if we do it. Chuck Todd joins us now. Good morning, Chuck. How are you?
Good morning, Mr. Cochran. I'm all right.
I guess this administration isn't unique in having that overall thought. They just say it out loud. It's okay if we do it. It's not okay if they do it.
Well, yeah, it would have been easier if he just said that at that point. Look, it's not the first administration to start spewing phrases that come across as pure hypocrisy. But obviously, they're this administration developing a reputation for it a little too much, a little too quickly, if they're worried about their long-term credibility.
Is there credibility left?
I have to tell you, I take everything with like 7 or 8 grains of salt now. I think it obviously depends on the reporter and depends on the person, but I think it certainly seems to me that when the president's words are no longer taken at face value, and we are already in that situation, we are told not to take everything he tweets or says as face value, then yes, they have a credibility problem.
As we go forward into the day, we get a little deeper into this investigation by Congress, which is a colossal waste of time. And isn't this one of these, be careful what you wish for? I don't understand why we're going down this road at all, because when Congress comes back and by all accounts says, yes, there was no investigation, yes, Barack Obama didn't sneak in with cat burglar clothes into Trump Tower and set up bugs, doesn't it make it worse for Trump?
Look, I think over time it does. If you're the administration right now and you're still trying to do health care and you're still wanting to do tax reform, you're still wanting to do some other thing, you need an ongoing, you need to sort of figure out how to compartmentalize this Russia business, right? And guilty or innocent, you've got to get it into a sort of an everyday box, because if you don't, it's just going to consume this presidency. You know, there was a point where even Democrats said, you know what, go get a special prosecutor for whitewash. This was in the early 94, because they were tired. Congressional Democrats at the time were tired of answering questions. I think congressional Republicans are going to get tired of this. I think we're going to see some sort of outside entity investigate this pretty soon, because I think even the White House is going to wish for it, if simply to put it in a box for a while.
Is there anything we're missing from those tweets last Saturday that is not already out there? In other words, can the president pick up the phone? Can he declassify? Can he clear this all up on his own without congressional investigations wasting time?
Of course he could. He could have called up Director Comey, and he hasn't done that in 5 days, apparently, to find out what's true and what's not. Here's what we don't know. Who is spinning him up on this? Who is spinning him up? Is it Roger Stone? Is it somebody in the White House? Who is somebody is spinning him up? And perhaps it's for their own necessity. But was this simply somebody handing him this article? Who sort of is making sure he sees these conspiratorial articles? That, to me, I think that's a piece of information I'd like to know.
Yeah, there was a point in the tweet where he said, last Saturday, where he said, just found out. So it does go to what Chuck Todd's talking about. Like, it was just handed this, he read it, and then he got angry and he tweeted it.
Exactly. So is that somebody knowing that they were going to be pushing his buttons? Is this something that they wanted as a deflection? You know, if you know the president is kind of prone to pop off, supposedly this White House team right now has been trying to limit the negative press coverage that he sees so that he doesn't create these unforced errors or these Twitter tweet storms that cause news cycle panic. And clearly someone thought it was important that he gets spun up on this issue, on this article.
Chuck, I just don't understand why the hesitation. Why not get in front of it? Why not say, you know what, let's have an investigation into the Russian hacking. Let's check out this WikiLeaks. What is the advantage to him at this point by not just calling it out and saying, let's start this investigation?
Well, there's two explanations that could be true here. Explanation number one, he really doesn't believe any of this happened. He has no knowledge of it. And he is feeling under siege, and he's fighting every second of it, because if you're innocent, wouldn't you fight it every second? Explanation number two is they're afraid of an investigation. They're afraid of it's going to get found. You know, I mean, I don't think there's a plausible third explanation.
I don't know what it would be. You know what's funny about the healthcare story? The reason you know the Republicans are in trouble on the health care story is nobody wants it named after them. Is it Trump care? Is it Ryan care? No, nobody. It's not me. So what happened last night?
That tells you. Well, I'll tell you this. If I'm Paul Ryan, I would not want to have anybody walking behind me right now.
Right.
If this bill goes south, there is no doubt in my mind this White House will pin the blame on Ryan. We'll pin the blame on House Republican leadership, and that they will do whatever they can to deflect. It is not unnoticed to me that the White House is doing everything they can not to fully embrace this bill, not to basically embrace the idea, but not the bill. Nobody wants to say it's their plan, right? And Paul Ryan is trying to say it's the president's plan. You've heard Tom Price say it's the House Republican plan. Nobody wants ownership of it, which tells me, if I were Paul Ryan and this thing goes south, just prepare for the White House to just dump the entire failure on him.
It's like hot potato with the bill, isn't it?
Yeah.
No, it's yours.
Yeah.
No, it's yours.
They're going to eventually make
it. Can I just tell you? They don't have a – this is where actually the healthcare debate right now is exposing to me the Republican identity crisis. Right? Both parties are going through their own versions of ideological identity crisis. And with the Republicans, are they a small government conservative party or are they a nationalist conservative party, right? And this health care bill sort of exposes all of these divides because the pure small government conservatives are going, what the heck are you doing? Like the whole point of our opposition to repeal and replace is no more government. You know, get the government, you know, don't do these government things. Pull it out. And Paul Ryan is trying, and Trump are trying to concoct a plan that both doesn't offend, you know, that doesn't upset the working class, their new working class voters who do, they just don't like the cost of Obamacare, but they want it, right? They just didn't like how much it cost, to the small government conservatives who don't want all this government intervention into the healthcare system. And I don't think you can bring these two sides together. And I think that that's what we're finding out.
So instead of going out with a broom... Instead of going out with a broom and whacking the legislative bee's nest here, why didn't they just start out with infrastructure, which looked like a gimme?
You know, because that would have been rational, logical, and a smart way to run the White House. I mean, if you leave with infrastructure, you'd have had Bernie Sanders, Chuck Schumer, and Elizabeth Warren shown up at the White House for an event.
You can't have that.
All of them, 3 days after the election, all of them put out statements indicating, well, you know, there are some things that we'll be willing to work with him on, you know, and it was always pointing to that infrastructure idea. But now it's too late. I think they're so poisoning the well. The sequencing, they created a false sense of urgency on healthcare, and then they forced themselves to deal with it first, statutorily. So now they have to pass a budget before they can use budget reconciliation to avoid a filibuster to pass healthcare. Well, how the heck are they going to pass a budget? They have to pass a budget in order to pass this health care on a 50-vote margin in the Senate.
Sounds like a day in the state of the...
Without a single Democrat.
Day in the state of Illinois.
Yeah, they are getting closer to Illinois. Yeah, they really are.
That is exactly right. You guys have gone, is it 25 years without a budget?
Yes, that's right. The last time we got a budget, the Bears won the Super Bowl the last time we had a budget.
Two feels like 20.
And last word, we've got boots on the ground in northern Syria, not confirmed by the Pentagon, but everybody says it's happening. Doesn't the president have to speak on this at some point?
Well, he may look to Barack Obama as a historical precedent on that one. How many times did we send special operation forces or small troops into these places? And, you know, President Obama did not want to bring a lot of attention to it. I imagine President Trump won't want to bring attention to it either.
That's awful. What are you doing Sunday?
Right now, I know one of my guests is going to be the HHS Secretary. We're going to do a little health care with Tom Price.
All right. Have fun. Always enjoy it. It's Chuck Todd, MTP Daily, and Meet the Press Sunday, the longest running show on television. Now celebrate. You know, did you know George Washington was their first guest? Did you know that?
I think so.
That's exactly right. Mm-hmm. It was back in the Russert days. Thank you, Chuck. It is 6:57, just ahead of the news here in a couple of seconds. We have a very important birthday to mention today. Let me bring Sandberg in on this. Whose birthday is it?
My stepson, Patrick.
Patrick's how old today?
He is 10.
Well, we like Patrick. I mean, honestly. We like both your kids, but since it's Patrick's birthday, we'll focus on him.
Yep.
He's a sweet kid.
He's adorable.
He's got a great face.
He does.
He's got a face where he goes, hey, tell me stuff.
Yeah.
I don't know how much I'll listen, but tell me stuff. And he seems like a great kid.
He's the cutest. I love him. He's got me wrapped around and, his little finger.
So. What are we doing for the birthday?
We are, I believe he's kicking off his day at his mom's this morning with some donuts and friends before chorus.
Oh, Donuts and Friends. Remember that show? Yeah. Donuts and Friends? Yeah, yeah.
And his mom and dad will be at school later in the day to the parents come and talk about, like, you know, stories from when he was little to the class, and they'll have some treats. Then he's coming over tonight, and he and his sister and I and his mom are going to have birthday dinner.
Oh,
it's very nice.
We have a
does he do cake, cupcakes?
We are doing a. I have a 32-ounce Rice Krispie treat.
Cool.
It's like a giant Rice Krispie treat with some candles. And he's
Dennis are running into guardrails right now. Right. So listen.
Yeah, and I also got a can of Ready Whip, even though it doesn't really go with whipped cream, but they love Ready. It's fun to squirt Ready Whip, you know. So we're doing that. So
yeah, you squirt it in their mouth. You hold them down. You
On Saturday, my parents are taking he and a buddy to the Sugar Factory in Rosemont. That's Sugar Factory is that hot place where kids go, like Kim Kardashian's sisters.
Yeah.
You can buy candy and get big drinks.
So by Sunday,
it's like the new Dylan's.
By Sunday, we expect Patrick to be running around with like Albert Einstein hair on a 4-day sugar high.
Yeah, that's pretty much it. So.
All right, so let's do the last chorus. We don't listen. He's 10 years old. He gets embarrassed easily at this point, right? So let's do the last chorus.
Okay.
Happy birthday to you. All right, Patrick, way to go. Way to go. Way to nail your birthday, dude. And his dad's working the Hawks game tonight, right?
He is working the Hawks game.
Yeah.
He gets to go to school today, so, and pick him up.
All right, well, there you go.
Yep.
Back at 7 o'clock with the news next on 720 WGN.
The Steve Cochran Show.
There are people who would want to leave Eastern Aleppo after being trapped in what has become this giant kill box, as it's been described. The situation has never been so bad, according to activists in Eastern Aleppo. And it's not just this military campaign that seems to have started again, that people are facing this indiscriminate bombardment of their neighborhoods. There's also that devastating humanitarian situation that is only going to get worse, as we've heard the warning from the UN, with people running out of almost everything.
7:13, word overnight that Marines are on the ground in backup positions but combat ready in northern Syria as the nightmare continues. No confirmation from the Pentagon yet. And joining us in studio, and it's an honor to have them, Dr. Zahir Salul and Suzanne Salul, founder and executive director of the Syrian Community Network. Welcome to both of you. I hope that pronunciation is close.
That's very close. Thank you very
much. Thank you for having us.
Nice to see you both. Let's start with the obvious question here with the immigration situation, creating refugees who are literally running for their lives. What does this mean for the people of Syria?
It's a terrible situation. This is the worst humanitarian crisis in our lifetime. We have 5 million refugees that are fleeing from all kinds of violent situations in Syria, including barrel bombing, missile attacks, even chemical weapons, and they're dispersed in many countries around Syria and in Europe. And I think our country should be hospitable to some of them. Historically, the United States have taken 50% of refugees from conflicts like Syria, and we have not taken our share.
That's absolutely true. And can I call you Suzanne?
Yes.
Suzanne, what do you do at the Syrian Community Network?
Well, I'm the executive director at this time. We work with Syrian refugees who are being resettled here in Chicago. Currently, we have about 140 families. That's about 600 people here in the greater Chicagoland area. Many of them are women and children, I would say 80% of them. And they're rebuilding their life, and we're helping them with their adjustment. Some have been here for 2 years, and some have only been here for a few months. And just recently, we had a few families that arrived in Chicago, and they're eager to start their new life here.
So along with the complete tumult of leaving your homeland behind and the heartbreak and the devastation of that, you're in a new country with a lot of strangers, a different language and all that. Well, what are the major barriers they're having to deal with?
Well, first of all, adjustment is always very difficult. You know, they have to come here, and those first 3-4 months, they have to learn the language, get a job, they have to enroll their children in school, and it's very difficult and overwhelming. So we at the Syrian Community Network provide this some support where we help them in their adjustment by providing mentors and tutors and community members. We connect them to community members. We invite them to events so that they can feel that they're part of the community and that they're being welcomed. In addition to, we provide to rental support because those first 3 months, they have some federal dollars that are given to them to help them with their security deposit and first month's rent, second month's rent. But that money runs out quickly. And so we provide a little bit of a cushion of rental support. And so that helps them also in their adjustment, that we're helping them with their shelter, basically, so that they're not evicted again from their apartments. Sure. And they end up being refugees again. So we're trying to help them adjust.
I cannot imagine.
Right. Chicago's a sanctuary city, and the mayor's been very forthcoming and very good about hosting some of these dinners. And we get so many emails, people saying, how can we help? Are you looking for host families or people to host dinners or supplies? How can people help? Because there's a lot of people who want to volunteer to
do
something.
Yes. You can go on our website, SyrianCommunityNetwork.org, and become a volunteer, and you can mentor a family and be in their home. We will do a training for you. You can donate a car to a family that really needs to have transportation because the father works and they have to take several buses to get to their work. So that's one way. You can host dinners. We're starting something called the Chicago Supper Club, where we are inviting people or leaders in the community to be part of the planning committee and to start hosting small dinners all over the city, different faith groups, and to include not just Syrian refugees, but refugees from every conflict and undocumented and Latino and anyone that's been affected by this recent climate that we're in right now.
Yeah. My daughter and her small group from church are working with a Syrian family in the Western Burbs.
So, that's wonderful.
Yeah, and she's had an amazing experience. Doctor, you know, we just saw the White Helmets documentary recognized at the Academy Awards, which is great. It's an amazing piece of film work, and I was hoping there'd be some buzz coming off that and some roll with the story. But again, it seems to get tamped down. I don't want to just blanket blame the media for this because we've got no shortage of stuff to talk about. But why has there been such a lack of focus on what's going on in Syria?
I think part of it is that the fact in the last couple of months, the media and the public were occupied with what's coming from the White House, including the Muslim ban, the Twitters of President Trump, and all of these things, which is distracting from important things that are happening in the world, including the Syrian crisis. What has been happening in Aleppo, in Syria, has been affecting us in Chicago. The global refugee crisis, the terrorism that is happening because of the presence of ISIS in Syria, the anti-refugee sentiment in Europe and United States, the xenophobia, all of this are stemming from the crisis in Syria. And unless we deal with this crisis, and that means we have to bring awareness of what's happening in Idlib and Aleppo and Damascus to the public here so they can apply pressure on our policymakers.
Sure.
So they can end the crisis. Then we will continue to deal with the ramification of the crisis.
What is the medical state on the ground?
It's terrible. We have hospitals that are targeted. We have doctors and nurses who are killed, mostly by the Syrian government and the Russians. And the public health system is disintegrated in Syria. And that's why my organization have been sending medical groups and doctors and nurses, supporting hospitals, mobile clinics inside Syria, training physicians, using innovation and telecommunication to connect to doctors in very dangerous zones in Syria in order to provide some health care and support.
So the longstanding rules of war to not bomb hospitals, they don't apply here.
Oh, I mean, that has been violated multiple times in Syria. Physicians for Human Rights, which is based in New York, have documented more than 350 hospitals being bombed and more than 750 doctors and nurses being killed in Syria. And this is a violation of Geneva Conventions.
Right. I think there's a false fear by a minority, about allowing the refugees in. Again, it's, I think, a very small minority. But do you want to say something to the fact that these are people who need our help? They need just the most basic supplies. They've left everything behind. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, no, it's really heartbreaking. And what they're dealing also is this guilt that they have, worrying about their family members who are still in Syria or who may be still in Jordan or in Lebanon. And that's a difficult toll on them. So they're watching the news very carefully. And I would urge everyone to go on our website to volunteer, to donate, to help a family, to sponsor a family. And then maybe reach out to us and host a dinner. Invite one or two families to your home and really welcome people with open arms.
SyrianCommunityNetwork.org.
Back to the Steve Cochran Show.
If you get some young kids who are coming in, managed to sneak into the United States with their parents, our Department of Homeland Security personnel going to separate the children from their moms and dads?
We have tremendous experience in dealing with unaccompanied minors. Yes, I am considering, in order to deter more movement along this terribly dangerous network, I am considering exactly that. They will be well cared for as we deal with their parents.
But you understand how that looks to the average person who is...
It's more important to me, Wolf, to try to keep people off of this awful network.
General John Kelly, Homeland Security. Separating parents from kids is an awful image, but the reality of it is much, much worse. In studio, Dr. Zahir Salul and Suzanne Salul, founder and executive director of the Syrian Community Network at SyrianCommunityNetwork.org. Pat Brady, jump in here. I got a question.
We've heard a lot about the humanitarian crisis here. You made a point earlier about who the bad actors are over there. I didn't realize so much the Russian involvement. Can you tell us about that?
Well, definitely. I was in Aleppo a few months ago, right before the siege. And in Aleppo, I visited seven hospitals. And I worked in a hospital that is underground for protection of doctors and nurses. And the people of Aleppo, the culprit of the crimes, the bombing of the hospital, is being done by Syrian government jets and also Russian jets. And everyone knows in Syria that the Russians, although they claim that they were fighting ISIS, but they were bombing civilians, they were bombing hospitals and schools in Aleppo and other cities. And they are partners in the crimes against humanity that is happening every day in Syria. That's why when there's a talk about partnering with Russia, people look at this with a lot of skepticism, because Russia and Syria means that they are the partners with Assad for crimes against humanity and war crimes. Of course, there's other bad actors in Syria. ISIS is the famous one, Assad regime. Iran also is involved, and the Hezbollah militias, they're involved. Unfortunately, this civil war has been happening now for 6 years, and the world attention has been dwindling, although the crisis is still going, and there's a lot of bombing and areas under siege that population do not have access to humanitarian assistance and food.
Russia's endgame here is simply the gigantic naval base that they have. Is that their number one concern?
And also challenging the policies of the United States. I think it's very important for us to understand that the main reason for Russia's involvement in Syria, besides the port of Tartus, that's where their naval base is to challenge the West and challenge United States policy. And I think early in the crisis, I was listening to the ambassador of Russia in the United Nations, who died just a few weeks ago, who said that we're not going to let you do in Syria what you have done in Libya. So I think, and they accomplished this easily because we did not challenge them in Syria, and now the whole Middle East is looking at Russia as the main superpower in the region.
There is a generalization, but a question that comes up by well-meaning people here, that where is the Muslim world in helping Syria out? You know, it can't just be on Jordan's shoulders. Where's everybody else to step up against the nightmare that's going on there? What's the answer to that?
I think that's a good question. But Turkey, which is a Muslim country, has 3 million refugees. Jordan has 1.5 million refugees. It's a Muslim country with very limited resources. Lebanon has about 1 million refugees. One out of four people in Syria, in Lebanon, is a Syrian refugee. One out of five people in Jordan is a Syrian refugee. So these countries, which are Muslim countries, have absorbed large number of refugees. The equivalent of 50 million refugees coming to the United States within 5 years. It's unimaginable for us, but in spite of their limited resources, they're doing that. But this is not enough, of course. The Muslim world and the OIC, which is Organization of Islamic Country, should have done much more than what they have done in order to solve the crisis. There are Muslim countries that are involved in the crisis, Iran and Saudi Arabia and Qatar and Turkey, and they should have done better to end the crisis than letting it go as unabated.
The giant problem that so many countries have in the Middle East have lessened the ability for others to step in now.
That is correct. The more parties involved in a crisis like Syria, the less likely that it will be easy to solve. And unfortunately, civil wars like Syria last for 20 and 25 years right now. Even if the crisis ended right now, it's going to take 25 years for refugees to go back to Syria, if ever. That's why it's very important to open the doors for some of them, at least, to be treated as equal in the West, whether it's United States or Canada or Europe.
Suzanne, when these families leave, what are they given along the way to keep them alive until they get here?
Well, they when they are in a host country, they sign up with the UNHCR and they get food rations and they get some financial support. But then the UN will reach out to a family if they see them as vulnerable, and they will see if they would fit the criteria for resettlement. And then they go through the long process of vetting where they have background checks and fingerprints and all these things that take them
about
2 years.
They're not flowing into the country.
They're not flowing in, exactly.
Yes, exactly.
And it takes about 2 years to complete the vetting process. And when they finally make it in here, come here, they have some, as I mentioned, some federal dollars allocated to them, but that runs out quickly. I mean, for example, you know, we have some refugees who are now been here close to 2 years, are doing very well. We have Dr. Firas and his wife, Rehab. Dr. Firas was imprisoned in Syria, tortured for 1 year. His family didn't know if he was alive, all because he helped his neighbor, because there was a targeting of doctors so that they can leave Syria. So he's been here since September 2015. He's working at a clinic. He's studying to do his recertification so that he can go back to residency and to rebuild their lives. There's a video, it's called This is the Rebuilding, if anybody wants to watch it.
Okay.
And it's about Dr. Firas and his wife, Rehab, how they're rebuilding their life in Chicago, and how when they first arrived, you know, everything was green. They could hear the birds, you know, because they were living under bombing. So they, you know, in Syria, people don't hear the birds anymore because all you hear are bombs. And so for him, this is what he noticed, that the birds, I mean, something
wow.
so simple. So we're really proud of Dr. Firas and Rehab, and she's an engineer in Syria, and she hopes to also study and recertify, and now she's expecting her second baby. She's almost due, and we're really proud of
her.
Well,
that's a wonderful story.
It is. And you said the majority are women and children.
Yes,
and again, they're coming here and need basic things, diapers
yes.
for the babies.
Exactly, diapers, help with rent, help yeah. with mentorship.
And a chance
language.
To work and make their way.
Right. Yes, and jobs. We just hosted a jobs fair for them last weekend, and we did two workshops, jobs readiness workshops, where, you know, talking about smiling and hygiene and handshaking and eye contact and those small things. And we prepared resumes for them. And we had Target that was a sponsor, and Axe & Noble, and a few
wow.
other big companies
Good
that
for
came
them.
Out. Yeah, and they were, so they went and greeted them when we taught them how to greet the employer and filled out the application. It was really nice. It was very touching. And so anyone who has a job at a restaurant, at any place that they would be willing to hire refugees, they're ready, willing, and able. They're all eager to get started, and they want to be independent. They don't want handouts. They
no,
want to be independent, but they just need a little cushion.
Well, that's the thing.
We
need to remember to
yeah.
take away our American stereotypes on this yeah. and understand that these are people that came from successful
yes.
lives in
middle
Syria.
Middle class.
People
yeah.
who were working hard in yeah. Syria who would like to replicate that here.
Yeah.
They didn't ask to be here, but now that they're here, they want to do their best to
we
be here
to
and contribute.
Yes.
And the main import or export of Syria before the crisis were Syrian physicians. We have 7,000
right.
Syrian physicians in the United States healing millions of
great doctors.
Fellow Americans. Yeah, and there are some of the most successful doctors in Chicago.
You among them.
Well, I hope so. My specialty is critical care medicine. I practice in Christ Advocate Medical Center, where we have at least 50 other Syrian American physicians in one hospital. Mayor Daley used to say that if you do not know a Syrian, then maybe you can check with your doctor.
Right. 6 degrees of Syrian separation.
Yeah, right.
It's great to see both of you. It's amazing
Thank
work
you.
You're doing. I don't know how you do it, but God bless both of you. And anytime we can help, I hope you'll ask. The
Thank
Syrian Community Network.org, SyrianCommunityNetwork.org. Please check the website out.
Thank
you. And as I said, my daughter is loves this family that she's been associated with.
Wonderful.
Thank you,
so everybody
Steve.
Can
Thank
do
you.
That. Thank you both.
Thank you, Steve. Thank you all. Thank
7:33, back in a moment with the big story on 720 WGN.
The Steve Cochran Show.
Senator Durbin joins us now. He's on his way, making his way over here to the Polish Museum. President Trump did something that's unprecedented, and I'd like to tell you it's good news, but it's not. Said a former president bugged the Trump Tower. Your thoughts?
Make a public report of it. We did not tap his phone. So you've got to ask yourself, what is he up to? If it were a serious charge, he would have made it at a press conference with the attorney general and everybody standing next to him. But to make it in a tweet at 6:30 in the morning, I think we all would know what this is. He's playing games, and he's doing it with the credibility of the presidency.
Senator Durbin, the other day on the show, here's the thing I don't understand as we welcome Eric Edelstein and Pat Brady. All of it. This is the thing I don't understand. All of it. That's the thing I don't understand. I don't understand any of it.
That's the part you're having trouble with?
That's the part I'm having trouble with. If he's trying to create a distraction from the Russian story, he brought more attention to the Russians.
He just walked himself into an independent prosecutor or special prosecutor, I think, by this. Because it's so serious. And I respectfully disagree with Senator Durbin. He didn't need to do a press conference. He needed to walk over to the FBI and say, hey, here's the evidence I have that the previous president wiretapped me. You guys need to look into this and let the investigators handle it, not play it in the press.
I think what we have to always keep in mind with Trump is there's a madness to the madness. So
and no strategy.
There's no method and no strategy. It's right. Just madness. And it's lashing out. I think Pat's absolutely right. I think one of the interesting things you've heard a lot of commentary about is the White House thought they were deflecting by saying, well, let's just kick it to Congress and then we'll shut up about it. But everyone who's thought about it says, you don't need Congress, you run the FBI. If the FBI did this, you have the information, Mr. President, so turn it over.
You literally call the director of the FBI and go, was there a wiretap subpoena granted against for Trump Tower?
Right.
Maybe he didn't want to hear the answer because the FBI director called me and said it didn't happen.
Right. The other thing that,
so
again,
did the NSI director too, right?
Yeah, they all said it didn't happen. But the other thing is, again, why it's so idiotic and not thought out and just destructive is because if he thought about it for 2 seconds, by law, which he doesn't clearly understand or care about, for a domestic wiretap in the United States with the FISA court, which is the terrorism court, it's basically a secret court where the FBI has to present evidence, or the Justice Department presents evidence of collaboration, conspiracy with a foreign power.
To subpoena United States citizens.
It's set up
for foreign agents. It's not set up for
correct
United States citizens.
But I'm saying for the White House or any criminal.
Because it's illegal to wiretap an American
right.
citizen.
You have to demonstrate probable cause that they're collaborating with a foreign power. So the assumption, even if it did happen, would be that there was evidence that you were collaborating with a foreign power, which, you know, it's just absurd.
And how weird of a monkey wrench into all of this is that Jeff Sessions has recused himself with anything to do with Russia. So does that basically, does he not have anything to say now about all these trickle down?
No, he's out. He's recused himself.
Well, that's what Comey's incidents? Frustration was, because Comey was trying to get in touch with the Justice Department over the weekend saying, who's in charge here?
Right.
Who can basically refute this, and they're, because Sessions...
Well, now let's be... I agree with that, but the holdups with the lower-level Justice Department appointments, the Democrats are holding up a lot of these appointments. Well, there should be people in place, but those are presidential appointments, those top spots at the Justice Department.
But a lot of them they haven't made.
A lot of them they hold. But the point is, you're right, who's running the Justice Department? That's not a good idea to have nobody run the Justice Department.
So we agree that this is a colossal waste of time. This congressional investigation of the tweets from last Saturday.
No, the Russia investigation, I think, is a legitimate investigation.
No, that's a legitimate investigation. Yeah. The investigation of Barack Obama ordering that there was a wiretap in the Trump Tower.
I think it's a huge waste of
time.
Well, there's nothing to investigate other than, you know, what is the standard and what is the consequence of someone in high office deliberately lying about somebody whose predecessor.
Well, Trump thinks a second term, I guess.
I guess so. But
does anybody care about lying
well,
anymore?
Well, take a step back, too, and look at this. And I agree with everything Eric's saying here, but this is about the sixth or seventh Trump conspiracy. If we go back to the birther thing when he was a reality star show, the 5 million people that voted illegally, the fact that Ted Cruz's dad was somehow involved in the Kennedy assassination with Oswald.
Thank God we got to the bottom of that.
And we can go on and on and on of these conspiracy theories. He comes up, and we're going to see, I bet, what happens here. His pattern is he never apologizes or say, oh, I was wrong. He, with the birther thing, remember when he was proven he was wrong, he said, well, I did a great service to the country pointing it out.
Yeah.
Pointing out nothing.
You know what's frightening about that, though? Words are very powerful. I mean, you can't just keep throwing things that stick because people hear these words, whether they're true or not, and you do get some people, many now, who are believing this.
He's winning the PR war within the people that support him right now.
So how does this not rise to the high crimes and misdemeanors part of the impeachment word at some point?
It's never been defined. What a hike that was, remember, during Clinton. It's never really been defined what it is. And I don't like that talk at all because it's not only bad
for
the economy.
Listen, I agree with you 1,000%. But at some point, aren't we talking about protecting the country from the president? That's how upside down this is.
But it was a 3-day cycle, and it's kind of died down already, which I thought this would last a lot longer. But it's kind of died down, and now we're talking about health care, thank God.
I don't think so. I don't think it's died down.
I don't think it's died down. And look, I still maintain what I've said in the beginning, and but what do I know? I said the guy would never be president. But
I can't believe you said that.
I know.
Yeah, you were on board with Trump the whole way.
I do think as this stuff piles up and his approval ratings deteriorate, which they are and they will, I think it's the key is those Republicans in Congress. When they feel that they can be untethered from him or, in fact, damaged by closer alliance with him, then I think the crazy really starts happening.
Yeah, and again, for everybody that goes, give him time, the only person who is getting in the way of Trump's agenda is Donald J. Trump. Because every time he does something that moves the ball in his favor a little bit, he throws three things in front of it because he can't control himself.
Remember like 5 years ago when he gave that speech to a joint session of Congress? Wasn't that like 5 years ago?
Does seem like that, doesn't it?
Yeah.
It
really
that was last week. Wasn't it?
Last week. Yeah. It was a week ago. Week and a half
a week ago. Traffic, and then we'll come back and talk about the fact that nobody wants their name attached to the new health care bill. Oh, no, it's not me. It's you. Eric Edelstein, what's your company's name?
AL Media.
How about you, Pat?
Next Generation Strategies. Thank you.
The Ryan Care, Trump Care, who cares?
Because Dave Ennett's not here, it's Ennett Care.
Oh, it's Ennett Care. So the Republicans control both houses, the House and the Senate, and the White House, and they can't stop fighting with each other about what they should do. I mentioned this to Chuck Todd earlier. Why not open with a win like infrastructure as opposed to taking this on?
Well, I was going to defer to Pat. He clearly doesn't want to.
No, because that's what we talked about the day. No. I think after the inauguration, we both talked about that would be the home run that everybody could agree to.
I mean, look, there's Carville has a great theory, and I think there's something to be said for it. You look at American political history, the first movers on health care are usually the first losers. And so it is a very, very complicated, difficult thing, which I think Speaker Ryan is finding right now. Yesterday was a bad day for the bill. You know, American Hospital Association, Medical Association, AARP all came out against it. Sometimes you'd say, well,
what do they know about medicine?
Well, you know, the thing is, though, there's more in the background of those folks, I think, than just we oppose it on good public policy. There's a lot more vested interests in this, in the cash flow, than there are necessarily what's good public policy.
That's fair, but and they are interest groups. But the bottom line is, I think the Kaiser Foundation and other independent groups who don't have, you know, interest group interests in the bill have all said less people will get care. Hundreds of thousands, if not millions of people will lose care. And some of the provisions in it are incredibly regressive. People who are the most neediest would have to pay more. The most people who have the need for the most care, older people, there's no longer, reasonable caps on what they could be charged by insurance companies. And, you know, it's hard for me to see, again, I'm not an expert on the Republican Congress and roll calls. It's hard for me to see this getting out of Congress. So
it just got through Ways and Means today.
Overnight.
Yeah. But here's, I think, the difference politically without getting into the details of the bill. The people that are going to oppose it will be the conservative, so-called conservative wing of the Republican caucus. But now Trump, even though he's not a conservative, like Chuck Todd pointed out this morning, can give them cover if he can come into their districts and help them, whereas we didn't have that before. So if you can hold that group together, maybe it's the moderates that fall off, but that's the way that I think the path the Republicans have. But Tom Cotton shot out a text this morning, one of the leaders in the Senate, a conservative from Arkansas senator, saying this bill's not going to work for me.
Yeah, it's a problem. And then you end up with these governors who do have some, Republican governors.
Even Governor Rauner said he's not so sure.
Yeah, I mean, the Medicaid cuts would be devastating to a lot of these guys' budgets. You heard Preckwinkle's comments about what devastation.
Well, the thing is, that's kind of a myth, though, because it depends on the dollar amount, but the program was set up, expand Medicaid for a couple years, and then dump it on the states 2 or 3 years down the road. So that was kind of the... It doesn't help either way.
Look, the bottom line is they're moving fast because they know the longer this sits, the more it's going to be picked apart and the less chance they have of getting a legislative win. I think if we're in the prediction business, it's hard for me to imagine, and they may get 218 in the House, but it's hard for me to imagine this gets through the Senate.
Has there ever been, though, a health care rollout, even going back to when Hillary Clinton first proposed it when she was first lady, has there ever been a health care rollout that that someone said, hey, this is great, this will be great, or it has really benefited any of us?
I mean, go back
to the higher premiums, the higher deductibles.
Go back earlier. Go back to when the first debates about Medicare were. Go back to Harry Truman wanting to have universal health care and, you know, all the charges of it being socialized medicine and all that stuff. This is a complicated issue that's deep-seated, and it's very easy to demagogue it, as we've seen on both sides. Mm-hmm. But the bottom line is we are at a point today, you can say that Obamacare is good, bad, whatever. The facts are more people have coverage today than ever. Our uninsured rates are lower, and the rise in premiums has gone down. It's not a perfect bill, but it did help begin to solve a problem. It should be improved rather than repeal and replace with something that's going to throw millions of people off health care.
Yeah, and if the idea to repeal it is just to say we repealed it because we told you we'd repeal it, you've broken promises before. Why would you stop now?
Yeah, and if we do, if we adopt the model that the ultra-conservatives in the party want, we're going to get that'll be the end of Republicans, I think, in leadership because the country will revolt. I don't agree with Eric that that Obamacare has had the results it's had. We can argue about that later, but politically, if we go, the Republicans go too far to the right on this, we're going to get killed on Election Day.
It feels like the Baltimore Colts moved out of Baltimore in the middle of the night. There was just no reason for the Republicans to create this fight for themselves. It didn't have to happen Tuesday night.
Well, they promised it. This was a huge promise from Trump. It was a huge... All these were...
But people were already disappointed.
You know what?
Follow the trend. People already figured, well, they'll get to it, I guess.
Ladies and gentlemen.
Dean Richards joins us from Channel 9.
Citizens of the world.
Some of the world's greatest entertainers are here tonight.
Ladies and gentlemen, may I present to you...
And tonight, guess what? It's going to be Dean.
Yeah, Hollywood. You know I love you more than when I should.
Are you doing Spud?
Yeah, Hollywood. Well, kiss me good.
Sometimes I have the meetings on air.
But that's okay. That makes it fun.
This is like behind the scenes.
Yeah, it's really cool. Syrian community.
Get me my laundry.
Thanks for the coffee, Steve.
I said double cream and sugar.
SyrianCommunityNetwork.org. That is the website for the guests from last hour. A bunch of people have been asking on text. Hi, Dean.
Good morning.
Everyone else, Dean, got
just
their...
Just enjoying a refreshing beverage while you were speaking.
Yeah. Everyone on the show, by everyone I mean Vandeveld and Andrea and Sandberg, got their 23andMe results back. I've not gotten mine back yet, but for people that were asking about that...
Yeah.
As soon as I get mine back, we'll do our compare and contrast.
You now, did send it in, right? Isn't it funny, Dean? It's just the women on the show.
23andMe, I know you talked about this. I can't remember what it is now.
It's DNA.
DNA testing.
Oh.
Because, and the premise for buying this for them for Christmas was, there's something going on with these three. I got to figure it out.
Well, he wanted to try to figure out the women on the show, yeah. And I said, yeah, I wouldn't. That'd take years.
Have you revealed your results?
I haven't gotten mine back yet.
No, but the from Andrea and
I have my results.
Yeah, I asked them.
I wasn't
wait.
Too.
Were you surprised?
I was not too surprised.
Don't give it up.
I'm not. Yeah. There's a little surprise, but not crazy surprise. Yeah.
Somebody gave me one of those packets too, and I have to do mine also.
It takes about a week to spit into the tube.
Dean, do yours, and we should wait for Dean, and then we can all do it together.
We'll find out in August. Start spitting today.
Or not.
Coming up in 2018.
Right. All right, here's what's coming up. The Women's Rights Day, International Day of Women yesterday. A bunch of artists got together to sign a letter on behalf of women. I mean, how risky is that? Artists supporting women. Star Wars 8, details coming up.
Spoiler alert.
Gabby Sidibe, is that how you pronounce
That's exactly how you say her name.
And Gabby Sidibe reveals details on her weight loss surgery. Ben Affleck and Jennifer Garner divorce news. Jennifer Lopez dating a new hottie. And Paul Schaefer? A hottie? Is this Paul Schaefer from Letterman?
Yes.
Paul Schaefer's in the news.
Yes, first album since 1989 coming out. We have a clip of it.
He was in studio with me in 1989 promoting his album.
Isn't he like this big? And I'm holding my fingers just like an inch away from each other right now.
He's about 5'3". He comes in. Hello, Steve.
He's a tiny. He's maybe one of the most accomplished musicians ever.
Unbelievable.
But he's this big.
Original Saturday Night Live band, Rock and Roll Hall of Fame band every year.
Yep.
Everybody wants to play with him. He's great.
Huge A-lister appearing with him on his first album since 1989.
Zamfir.
We'll have the clip of that coming up in 2018.
Zamfir and the Pan Flute?
Yes.
I knew a guy.
Slim Whitman?
I knew a Greek guy whose nickname was Zamfir. I'm not kidding you.
What was his
Did
real
he play
name?
Play the Pan Flute?
His real name was Dean. I'm not kidding.
No, it was
no,
not.
No, I swear.
No one would go from Dean to Zamfir.
It's a long story.
Like you didn't consider it.
You'll be calling his name. Oh, 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 oh. Dean Richards, the entertainment editor.
All right, we got a lot to get to, Dean. A lot to get to.
It's a busy morning.
23 artists signed a letter in support of women. Who are the 23 and where are the rest of them?
I'm going to give you some of them, not all 23, but Beyonce, Madonna, John Legend, Coldplay, Salma Hayek, Julia Roberts, Dakota Johnson.
They're all supporting women? This doesn't surprise me.
Well, they signed a letter, you know, just to kind of emphasize it, saying that, that we are living in a time right now when rhetoric is suggesting that we may be going back in time, decades backwards, for women and girls at risk. And they are calling upon the U.S. to be a global leader and positive role model on human rights.
Okay, well, that's good.
I would sign that.
Yeah, I would too, but they didn't ask us.
Right.
Star Wars 8.
Okay, spoiler alert now, because I'm going to give you some details about...
Takes place in outer space system?
It does apparently take place in a galaxy far, far away.
Okay.
They had a little preview, not the whole movie, but they showed a couple of scenes to Disney shareholders,
okay,
which I'm offended because I am a Disney shareholder. I feel like I should have been invited.
Yeah, why weren't you included?
But same reason I wasn't invited to the letter.
And you're also signing. Dean Richards.
So, as you may recall... Spoiler alert,
yes,
at the end of Star Wars 7, Daisy Ridley's character, Rey, climbs a mountaintop. Who's up there? Luke Skywalker.
Right.
Mark Hamill.
Right. He turns around and goes, yo, what's up?
I actually didn't
say anything.
Their eyes meet, and the movie ends.
Yes.
A lot of people speculating, is that his daughter? What's the deal?
And by the way, Luke Skywalker has aged, just so we're clear.
Oh, yes. Has not been moisturizing.
No.
LA Times reporter Daniel Miller was there. Somehow he got invited.
How's Daniel Miller? And he's no Dean Richards.
And I didn't. But he tweeted yesterday, just saw more Star Wars The Last Jedi. That's the name of Star Wars 8. And he says, in it, Luke asks Rey, who are you? Doesn't know who she is.
Oh.
And then we see her handling a lightsaber. I presume that's not code.
You think they have a fight?
We see her at least, it says, deftly handling a lightsaber.
Oh.
So I don't know what that means.
Maybe.
But he doesn't know who she is.
Well, maybe he doesn't know she's his daughter.
Well, that's possible. It has been apparently quite a few years.
Yeah.
He also tweeted that making a...
Hey, Skywalker was a slut. You knew that. He got around.
are done, right? Can I listen again?
No, I still got a little more.
Okay, hold on.
Making appearances in the movie footage that they saw, Chewbacca, General Leia,
uh-huh,
is going to be in, and Finn, that's the John Boyega character from the last movie.
Okay.
And
Carrot Top.
All sorts of settings are seen.
Wolf Blitzer?
Mountains, oceans, forests, deserts, looking suitably epic and exotic.
Alex Trebek?
He says.
Will be in it?
Movie's going to be out December 16th. Andre, you can listen again.
Okay. Gabby Sidibe.
So she reveals in People magazine that she's had gastric bypass surgery. She was, the star in Lee Daniels Presents Precious Lee Daniels,
mm-hmm,
if you remember.
Was she nominated for an Oscar?
She was nominated for an Oscar for that. And she's currently starring in... Empire on Fox.
Right.
But she revealed that basically they cut out half of her stomach.
Wow.
Because she decided to go through this procedure because she said she just could not lose the weight on her own. She couldn't do it on her own. She was diagnosed with type 2 diabetes and so went ahead with the...
How much weight did she lose?
With the surgery. They haven't said, but she's posted some pictures on her Instagram. And she's got a ways to go, but she's. If I'm going to guess, I'm going to say she's lost 30, 40 pounds.
Still recognizable?
Definitely.
Okay.
Yeah, definitely.
Ben Affleck and Jennifer Garner not getting divorced. They've never been happier.
Sources say that they at least have decided not to go through with the divorce. They've called that off. They are continuing to not live together, Steve, but on the same property.
They got separate houses?
I think it's a guest house kind of thing.
Who's in the guest house?
Ben.
Yeah, it makes sense.
Ben's in the house. She's in the big house with their three children. But they say that Jen was the one who called all this off. She really wants to work things out with Ben, which is very nice.
It is nice because they have a family. Did she date after the divorce?
I don't remember any dating on her part.
Because he's been sleeping with everybody.
Even Luke Skywalker.
Yeah, that's what I'm hearing.
Yeah.
Jennifer Lopez, speaking of dating. Boy, I tell you what. Is she 47, 48 years old? She is something else, man. She looks great.
You mean attractive?
Yeah.
Yeah. She's
dancing her butt off.
She looks great. She looks great. There were rumors that she was dating Drake. But
the snack cake guy?
No. Who's Drake the snack cake guy?
Drake cakes. Drake little Drake snack cakes.
Are you thinking about Little cakes? Debbie?
No, they're Drake cakes. Maybe it's an East Coast thing. I thought it was here, too.
I don't know that cake.
Oh, okay.
I don't know that cake. But okay. Let's just say she was also dating Little Debbie, just for fun. It was quite a hostess, if you know what I mean.
Hello!
So she said on The Daily Show earlier this week that she's not with Drake. However, the New York Post, pillar of journalism, says that she has been seen with former Yankees player Alex Rodriguez all over the place.
Oh, well, that's a good choice.
So J-Lo and A-Rod apparently bonding over their Latin roots, their love for New York, and their love for their kids.
And her love for being with a guy who will disappoint her and lie to her.
Well, can't have everything.
What is that? And finally, Paul Schaefer.
Yeah, Paul Schaefer has not had his own album out since 1989. He's been band leader with David Letterman for the past 33 years. Since Dave retired about a year and a half ago, he's pretty much been laying low. But now he's got this new album coming out, and the first song from the album will be out next week. The song is called Happy Street, and joining him on the first track of this album is his old friend Bill Murray.
Oh, that's cool.
Bill Murray, who, as you may recall, back in the SNL days when Bill Murray did his Nick the Lounge Singer act, it was Paul Schaefer on the keyboard.
That's
how long they've been friends together. So Bill Murray, happy to join him on this track called Happy Feet. Here's a little taste of it.
Hey, Bill. Hey, Bill Murray. Hey, wait up. Wait up. Let me catch up to you.
Hey, Polly. Nice running into you out on the street.
Last person I thought I'd ever run into. It's great to see you.
Well, great to see you.
How you doing?
Right now, I'm just loving the way that I'm walking, baby. When life is feeling sweet, it has a certain beat. Everything's groovy when you're walking down Happy Street. When things ain't cool, here's my real simple rule. Why not just change your point of view? And when you know, hey, that's the way I should roll, all you gotta do.
Well, it's kind of catchy, right?
Yeah, you know what it feels like? It feels like a kid's album. It's so
great to be alive. I don't think it's a kid's album, but this first song, the video for it is all animated.
There you go.
And it does look like a kid's video in that sense because it's all animated. But there's an animated Bill Murray, an animated Paul Schaefer. And if you look at the video carefully, we'll post it. There are little bits and pieces of Bill Murray's career, of Paul Schaefer's career in the backgrounds, in windows, and little hidden Easter eggs, Steve, is what the kids like to call it.
Nice.
Little treats like that in the video that are kind of fun to watch. And the song is, it's kind of catchy.
Cute. Yeah. Yeah, I like it. Yep. See you tomorrow.
I will see you tomorrow.
That's Dean. I'm Steve. You know who you are. Back after this.
The Steve Cochran Show.
Let's see action, let's see people, let's see freedom, let's see who cares. Take me with you when you leave me and my shell behind us there.
Second all-time wins, three cups. These are all career markers. But you know how you know you made it? When you're the only guest on the Steve Cochran Show that can request your own bump. We play The Who for Coach Q. Sponsored by Hooters, the original wing joint. And I'm sure, Coach Q, you agree with us that this is one of the major career honors for you. You pick the music.
There you go.
Yeah. Favorite Who song of all time?
Maybe Bubba O'Reilly.
Yeah. You know the words?
No, sometimes.
You want to do it right now?
No.
Hey, big night. The Hammer's back and Oduya too. Talk about that.
Well, it's good. We got full complement of defensemen and forwards tonight, and
you know, getting everybody and all your options available. We got some tough decisions to make as well if they're in the lineup, and you know, our defense and our team's played well here recently. So, you know, that's always part of it as well. But good to see Johnny returning and getting a chance to play, and gets to play with a lot of familiarity with him and Hammer, and so the two of them should you know, getting back together again, and both being off. You know, hopefully they can recapture that feeling quickly.
Is there a rhythm with somebody you really enjoyed playing with that can come back like riding a bike, or does it take time?
Sometimes it's tough to forecast that, but it's probably, you know, we'll see. But I think that you can always recapture that feeling, whether it's immediately or with time. But we'll, you know, these guys played a lot of important minutes and shifts and matchups, and, you know, did a pretty good job against some pretty good players. So it's a, you know, we feel that that's another good option. We still have other options as well with those guys splitting up with other guys. And but I think the nice thing is Dunks and Siebes have come back together again, and those guys have played extremely well over the last four games. And so that's that gives us, you know, now you got 2, 3, 4 pairs now that we feel very comfortable with that depth, and we know how important it is as you're progressing here.
Coach, you got 17 games in 31 days coming up here, and Scott Darling going to miss some time. What's your comfortability level with Jeff Glass right now? Do you see him getting an opportunity here? You got some 3-game and 4-night situations coming up.
We got a couple of those, and we'll see how we'll play it out here. We're definitely going to be busy. Corey, you know, he likes the net. He doesn't mind the workload. His play and how he's handling it and how he's feeling will dictate a little bit of that. But watching Jeff in practice here, he looks like he's competitive. He wants an opportunity here. So we'll see how it goes. And I'm not going out too far as far as saying he's going to play or going to start. But sometimes the decisions change quickly, and your options are what they are. And But certainly his game changed from where he was just a little while ago to all of a sudden being up here in the NHL and with a chance to play.
So there's no automatic rest nights for Corey, even given this circumstance. You're going to see what happens.
Yeah, that's how we're going to go about it right now. Yeah.
Seems right. That's probably why you've won all those games. The Ducks coming in, who's a player or two we need to watch on their side?
Well, they've got they got their 3 big guys on all on different lines with the Perry, Getzlaff, and Kessler all on different lines. So they've got some balance in their lineup. They got a real young mobile defense that can go and they can skate, and then they play a physical game, and you know they're gonna try to press us and forecheck hard, and they play a heavier game than a lot of teams. So that'll be tonight's challenge, that we want to make sure that we go to where we got to go to be successful, and let's not get distracted, or let's not get slowed down. So that's what we're looking for.
I don't have any sense that there's any bad blood on your side or our side going back to that playoff run for a couple of years in a row. Do they have any bad blood?
I think that that series was very, very, very competitive. It was hard fought. I think the physicality in both ways was definitely taxing. Our defense got exposed in certain nights and some long playoff games and the overtime, and then you go 7 games in a grueling series. And you know, I commend our guys on how we withstood that battle and come back from 6-7, and finding a way to win was a huge, huge victory for us. And you know, I think everybody with time, you know, playoff battles are always bring a little bit more intensity and rivalries and emotion to the game. And we haven't seen them for a while here, so. We know when we play this team, it's always a good game. It's always a close game. It's always competitive. And I think you still have some memories of what happened in a few years back.
That physicality part, Coach, you guys are last in the league in hits, but yet, you know, that's not your style. You control the puck. But does that number jump out at you at all? Does it bother you?
I don't know about bother. I think, certain guys are certain kind of players. Some guys we have a little bit more skill than some teams, and some guys have more forecheck kind of players. And but we definitely improved our game where we have the puck a lot more. And when you do that, you're probably receiving a lot more hits. But we feel that you know, we still want to play a pressure game. We want to go to people quickly, whether there's some guys engaged physically or not. I think pressuring the puck and going to people with a good stick is equally effective as sometimes complete body checks. But we feel that the one thing is we don't want to get slowed down knowing that they're physical or they're more physical than us. Let's go to where we got to go. Let's get to the front of the net. Let's win some puck battles in the corner. Let's have support of the puck, and you know, let's go to the hard areas and not change the way we have to play to be successful.
Coach, this might be a crazy question, but do you or the guys know when there's a streak going on, or do you know the numbers that are coming up? Does a player know, oh, I'm this close, so, you know, I'm this many away from 200 goals, or we won 8 in a row, let's go for 9? Do you look at the number? Do they keep track of the numbers at all?
I don't know if they keep track, but sometimes there's reminders. Sometimes you get asked the questions, and, you know, sometimes whether you're reading the media notes or there's, you know, or some guys, they may know. We did mention to our guys that we accomplished the road record the other day, and that was a nice feather in their cap, knowing that, you know, the Blackhawks have, and the tradition and their history is tremendous, and being a part of that was special. And but, you know, I think we're, you know, as you're going into games, it's more you're into the short-term thinking as a coach. You're thinking, how are we going to win? How are we going to get the best out of everybody? And individually, guys, you know, we want them to be the best they can be. So everybody has a motivation going into the game. And, you know, but it's all about what we can do to complement our team.
Big stretch. Big stretch. Ducks tonight, then to Detroit with the Red Wings, and then Minnesota comes here. Going to be fun.
Yeah, it's going to be, we're busy. It's in some tough games and a lot to be sorted out.
Need me to check your mail or anything? You got a lot going on.
Oh, no, we're all right.
Okay. Well, call me if you need me to run any errands.
All right.
Wouldn't swing it, by Walgreens?
Wouldn't it violate the TRO that he has? You're not supposed to go
near
his house?
He's got a restraining order? Yeah. Is that me? Probably is me. All right, Coach, enjoy your day.
All right.
See you later. That's Coach Q from your Chicago Blackhawks. You know what's sponsored by? Hooters.
Oh, it's a way of life.
Yes, it is. And the original wing joint. Coach Chris Collins from Northwestern coming up as we continue on 720 WGN.
This is the Steve Cochran Show.
1.7 to go in a tie game.
I guess he can't run it.
Taphorn heaves it down the floor.
Got it.
Part of the catch. Puts it up.
Yes!
Wildcats win! Wildcats win! Derek Parton at the buzzer for the win! And the Wildcats have beaten Michigan 67-65.
Are we going to get trampled?
They're all in a pile right in front of us. Unbelievable.
Go Cats.
It'll never get old. Don't forget, 9 o'clock hour, Spot the Purple. Yeah, I wonder what today's is. Spot the Purple, and when you do, you'll be able to hear the roar. Hear the roar, Spot the Purple. Be the seventh caller, win Northwestern gear. Coach Chris Collins joins us now, getting ready for the Big Ten tournament, which opens today. Good morning, Coach.
Good morning. How are you guys holding up without Dave with you this morning?
Actually, things seem to be running more smoothly.
Yeah, really well.
Yeah. I don't know what it is. I'm sure it has nothing to do with Dave being gone.
I'll be sure not to tell him that when I see him.
Yeah. Mark Carman's in. You know Carms, and he seems to be handling things well.
Minimal errors over here, Coach. Doing the best I can.
I'm not surprised. Carm is as good as it gets.
Both of the men, Coach, dressed in purple today. Cochran and
I like
Carm,
it.
Both in their purple dress shirts.
It's an honor of you.
Yeah.
It's an honor of you. Did you get a good draw for your first game? You like that time?
Well, it's not easy to play late. You know, just your nervous energy, your anxiety. It's my opinion is to get up and play in the afternoon when you're in these tournaments. It's never fun to sit around all day and have to wait till 9 o'clock to play, but it is what it is. You know, we try to get our guys prepared as possible, and we just found out last night who our opponent was going to be with Rutgers beating Ohio State. So we have a good day of prep and get these guys ready to go. And fortunately, we played these guys a couple weeks ago, so I think both teams are pretty familiar with one another, and should be a good game. Rutgers is playing a lot better. They won their last two games, and they're a really tough-minded team.
Yeah, they got good at the wrong time because they really had a rough year. I think they had 3 wins when they played you guys. So this is nobody to look beyond, right?
Yeah, you know, this is a team they actually remind, and I told their coach this, they remind me a little bit about, you know, where we were, you know, in the last couple of years. They've played everybody tough all year long. just hadn't been able to quite get over the hump in the close games. And, you know, the last two games, they beat Illinois in the last home game last weekend, and then last night beat Ohio State in a close game. So obviously their confidence is growing. They're learning how to win, and it's going to be a dangerous opponent. We're going to have to be ready to play tonight.
Coach, I don't want to put you in an awkward position, but they're not exactly selling a ton of tickets playing out in D.C., except for Maryland. And I know you don't want to get ahead of yourself, but that's your next matchup here if you can get past Rutgers. That's a tough draw for you guys. Bottom line, it's going to be a legit road game because they're the closest team to D.C.
Well, I mean, it's part of the Big Ten's plan to expand. And, you know, we're in D.C. this year. Next year, we're in Madison Square Garden. And, you know, and having teams like Rutgers and Penn State and Maryland trying to get more of an East Coast presence with our league and, you know, raise the presence in different areas. And, you know, Maryland, I'm very well aware of Maryland's fan base. They're awesome. I mean, you know, being at Duke for so many years, you know, they're going to have that place packed here playing at home. And I just hope to be there. You know, tournaments are, you know, situations where you can never get ahead of yourself, especially in these one and done type environments. And, you know, when, you know, tell the guys all the time, all you can do is play the game in front of you and win and hope to see the next day and then figure out who you got next. But should be exciting. It's been fun. We got up to D.C. On Tuesday night, and, you know, we were able to practice yesterday and kind of, you know, the guys get a chance. It was a beautiful day up here and a great city and a good environment for the tournament.
Is it tough when you go into a new gym when so much is on the line as we get later in the year because lighting is different, you know, hoops are different? People go, oh, it's basketball. You know, rims can be a little tighter, that type of thing.
Yeah, no, every place you play is a little bit different. Like you said, the depth perception when you're shooting, the lights in the building, you know, the ball you're playing with. In the tournament, they break out brand new basketballs. It's a Spalding deal where, you know, most of the teams have their shoe-affiliated ball that they play with. So there's a lot of factors when you play in an arena for the first time and with a different ball. And, you know, the teams that can adjust to it and the quickest are the ones that are going to be the most successful. So fortunately for us, we played in an NBA arena earlier this year. We played in Barclays Center in Brooklyn when we played Texas and Notre Dame. And, you know, we had a little bit of experience there. So hopefully it won't be too much of an adjustment for our guys.
Before I let you go, Carms was telling me about a story in the Trib this morning.
Coach, you were a ball boy. Everybody knows this, but I didn't know the part where Michael Jordan walks in the locker room. He hands you his shoes, and you proceed to basically—is this true? Put them in your duffel bag because you thought it was a gift. And he's like, "Dude, those are mine. Can you lace those up?"
It was my first day ball boying for the Bulls. I was a seventh grader in the locker room in complete awe of seeing Michael in front of me. He jams his brand new pair of Jordan box in my chest. Doesn't say anything. And I had no idea why he was doing that. I was new. I was a rookie. So I just kind of put him in my arm and tried to slide him in my my duffel bag. And I got a quick talking to from him saying, "What the hell are you doing? Those are the games. Yeah. Those are the shoes that I'm playing in tonight. I need you to lace them up so I can get ready to play." So needless to say, I was pretty mortified. That was the start of a great relationship between me and Michael.
Coach, this was just into our newsroom. Tom Brady's Super Bowl jersey is still missing. Any truth to the rumor you might have that in the same duffel bag?
It's in his duffel, yeah.
I will neither confirm nor deny those rumors.
I got a good feeling about tonight. Go out there and get one.
No, I appreciate it, guys. And I'll make sure to give Dave a big hug this morning from you guys. Tell him you miss him.
Oh, big time. Tell him.
Oh, yeah.
Forgot he was gone. All right, thanks, man. See you later. It's Coach Chris Collins from your Northwestern Wildcats, and it's good. I like their chances. Yeah, I mean, it's Rutgers, but the Rutgers is better. They should beat Rutgers, and, you know, Maryland's another animal, but, you know, maybe they make a nice deep run in the Big Ten tournament here.
And they would have beaten Maryland at home at Mello Trimble, not go nuts, so maybe he won't do that. But that whole D.C. thing, come on.
That's ridiculous. It's a minute before 9. Coming up, very busy 9 o'clock hour on 720 WGN.
The Steve Cochran Show.
The abuse our kids experience, the kids that come to Mercy Home, it takes many forms.
These are young people, these are families in our city and in our community who have potential and purpose and plans for their life, you know, but trauma and other things have kind of presented some roadblocks.
Anytime that there's an abused kid, that's the responsibility of all of us.
Being from
Chicago and being from many areas that they're from, it could have been me.
Please join Mercy Homes March for Kids.
Join Mercy Homes March for Kids.
Join Mercy Homes March for Kids.
Our friend Bill Rensing standing by, looking for volunteers to take to the streets. March to Save At-Risk Kids and Mercy's Home March for the Kids campaign, as you just heard. And let's grab a phone here and get Bill on the radio. Good morning, Bill.
Good morning. How are you?
Good. How you been?
I've been great. No complaints. Excited for St. Patrick's Day and everything that we're doing for the Mercy Home for Boys and Girls. And I always appreciate you having me on to talk about what a great Chicago institution the Mercy Home is.
It certainly is. But before we get to that, how's your family?
Great. My wife, Juliana, is sitting right next to me. She sends her love.
Hi.
Hello.
Give her a hug for me.
Duke is off to school, so all good. We're getting our day started here.
What are you guys going to do today?
Well, I've got some work to do, and we're on the west side of America, so it's a little bit earlier here. And going to be, you know, just the normal stuff, getting things rolling over at the restaurants, and Juliana's got some stuff with her clothing line, so we're constantly on the go.
They're in the L.A. Rancic compound.
Yes. I wouldn't say compound, but it's been great, and it's been a great 2017, and hopefully you guys are doing just as well.
We're doing just fine, thank you, my friend. Say hi to Bill.
Hi, Bill. Hi, Juliana.
Hi there.
I can't believe Duke is in school. I swear to God, I always want to say, "How's the baby?"
I know.
He fights it every day.
Oh.
I don't want to go to school. I mean, it's unbelievable.
Right?
It's in the DNA, I think, because he's only 4 and a half.
Yeah.
And it's really something.
Well, we don't know how he got to 4 and a half. It seems like he skipped a couple of years.
Right.
And he is so tall. People think he's 6 or 7.
He's so cute.
And, you know, when he's not, they're surprised when I tell them that he's only 4 and a half.
And, Bill, we're not taking it personally that you guys didn't come in today with Mama DePandy's meatballs.
Would be tough.
I know they're my favorite.
Tomorrow, though, I can assure you of that.
It's like a fest.
It's unbelievable. Yeah. The only problem is when you send the meatballs, people from the tower come in. We haven't even met.
Right.
People come in off the street.
The meatballs are a big seller, and I think we're gonna have to send in Mama DePandy's Bucatini Pomodoro because that is always everyone's favorite. It's the number one seller every night at both the RPM in Chicago and the RPM Italian in D.C. So.
Yeah, so you know what? I don't even know what he said. It just sounded dirty.
I know.
In all the good ways. Yeah. All right, so let's talk about the Mercy Homes March for Kids. Where, when, and how?
Well, you know, the Mercy Home in March is really their time when they try to raise as much funds as they can to help support all the different programs that they have. And we really tie a lot of it around the different parades for St. Patrick's Day. So you're going to see a lot of people in these green aprons, and they're going to be asking for donations. And, you know, hopefully if you see them, you'll put a few bucks in or more, or 10 or 20 or whatever you can give. And this is the month that we try to shine the light on all the good work that they do. Because, you know, we're hearing Chicago in the news, and when I travel around the country, the first thing people say is about the violence. And really, this is the first step to helping correct it, because they're getting these kids who are coming from broken homes, they're abused, they're victims of violence, and, you know, Mercy Home really stops the cycle. And they take these kids in. It's 24/7. There's over 600 kids that they are currently housing and taking care of on an annual basis. And they're getting these kids off the streets. They're arming them with the right tools to make the right decisions. And that's how we're going to stop a lot of this violence. You know, we need more places like the Mercy Home and really give these kids a level playing field.
Amen.
It's one of the oldest, right, Bill? One of the oldest facilities for kids, right?
In 1887.
The yeah, it's wonderful.
I can't believe that. And I started volunteering there. It's funny, almost, I don't know, probably 17 or 18 years ago, maybe a little longer, I would come as an after-school tutor. So I would go there once a week. And I would help tutor these kids and really got to see what they do and how they help these young boys and girls. And I wanted to do more. So if you can't give money, give your time, because certainly these kids can use people to look up to and some role models. And I tried to do that. And hopefully, you know, many of your listeners will go to mercyhome.org. And there's a lot of different programs that they can volunteer and help these kids because it's so important. I'll tell you, I see the number of kids they send off to college. And it's just something, you know. Many of these kids, in fact, I don't have the exact statistic, but when they leave the Mercy Home, they're the first in their family to ever attend college.
Right.
Ever in the history of the family. So, you know, they're making Chicago a better place, I can tell you that. And you know, Father Scott, who runs it over there, is just such a great man, and he's got a great team of people that really put their heart and soul into it.
99.9% of the funds for Mercy Home are raised through the March for Kids efforts and other efforts throughout the year, but point being, privately raised. It's a big deal. And here's a couple of things you need to keep an eye on: the Forest Park St. Patrick's Day Parade, the Chicago St. Patrick's Day Parade, the Southside Irish Parade, the Northwest Side Irish Parade, downtown Chicago all over on the 17th, and the Tinley Park St. Patrick's Day Parade. You look for those green and white aprons, and you'll know you're helping Mercy Home. But mercyhome.org, that's a great place to start, I guess, right?
It's a great place to start, and if you ever want to go take a tour, they're always their doors are always open, and they love to show people all the great work they're doing, and it's such an impressive facility, and they're constantly growing because there's a constant need. You know, so they're always adding on and trying to get more beds and more rooms. And if it's you know, without the support of all the folks in Chicago, you know, we wouldn't be able to do it.
Thanks for the work you're doing there. And tell Juliana I thought it was a good talk.
They thought it was a good talk, honey.
Oh, my God. My best. Good morning.
She said she did her best this morning.
Yeah, I thought you nailed it.
She's awesome.
Home run. Home run.
Hey, behind every great man, right, Bill?
Behind every great man is an even greater woman.
That's exactly right.
Juliana's awesome.
That's exactly right. All right, buddy. All the best.
She's my rock.
Anytime you need anything, you know that.
I will have meatballs there tomorrow. Mama DePanty's meatballs, so don't eat breakfast, guys.
I like the subtle way that Andrea brought it up.
Bill, we always
aren't just for breakfast anymore.
Bill, we want to see you and Juliana, of course, you know, in addition to the meatballs next time.
But if the
meatballs show up. We will bring them in when we are back in town. We love coming there. I love your studio. I mean, it is such a cool studio.
It's the best.
You guys have
we love you guys.
All right, man. You be well. It's Bill Rancic. And coming up, the Barefoot Contessa next on 720 WGN. Steve Cochran Show continues, and Ina Garten joins us. Before I let you two in to frighten the Barefoot Contessa with your fandom, let me say hello and welcome to the program. How are you?
I'm fine, Steve. How are you?
I'm doing fine. It's a pleasure to talk to you, and we'll talk about what you have coming up in town, the show and things, but just know the women you're about to speak with are rabid Barefoot Contessa fans. I know you get this all the time, but they're two of the biggest.
Thank you. That's very sweet. Thanks.
But I had a quick question. I love your background. You were in politics, and you worked in the White House.
I was. I worked in nuclear energy policy in the Ford and Carter administration. How unlikely is that? That's a natural segue to the food business, right?
Right. So how do you go from that to being one of America's most celebrated fun cooks?
Thank you. That's very sweet. You work really hard. I think, you know, I left Washington thinking I really wanted to do something on my own. And I saw an ad for a business for sale that was a specialty food store in a place I'd never been before. It was in the Hamptons. And I just thought, this is really, I remember walking into the store and they were baking cookies. And I thought, this is so different from what I do. And I thought, well, this is what I want to do. So I started with a very small store and I built that up and eventually sold it to the employees and started writing cookbooks. And who knew that was like the beginning of my life.
Ina,
it's just been a great ride.
It has indeed. It's such a pleasure to talk to you. I've gotten about three different texts today saying, tell Ina hello. Is she looking for new friends? I mean, you're so sweet and you're so approachable. And your recipes are really, anybody can do them. I mean, is that kind of what you geared
Thank
it for?
You.
It's not crazy different ingredients, but, you know, like I could go home or Mary could go home and try these recipes at home, which we have.
Well, you know, one of the things that I was nervous about when I started writing cookbooks is that I'm not a trained professional chef. I've spent spent decades in the food business, but I've never really worked on a line like some of the major chefs. And I thought I was very nervous about writing cookbooks because, I'm not classically trained in any way. I'm self-taught. But I think in the end, it turned out that cooking is hard for me. It's hard for everybody. And it's and I think it's just that anxiety that really translates into really simple recipes that I know I can do. I know I can nail it. And it's going to come out great every time. And that really kind of connected with people in a nice way. I wish I could say I did it deliberately, but it worked out really well.
Yeah. Some of the recipes I make all the time, Ina, is your seafood gratin, the Italian wedding soup, your perfect roast chicken, your coconut cake. Mine don't always look like your pictures, but they taste good every time.
Isn't that great?
I know.
I love that. That's why I love when they come out looking exactly like the picture, so you know you've nailed it.
Yeah.
And that said to me, I should go to jail for that coconut cake.
That is, incredible. Are you, one thing I don't do is like, I don't ever put my food on a pretty tray and go down to the beach with my friends and serve it there, though. That's not, I haven't nailed that portion yet.
You go into the family room.
Yeah.
Or you're not married to Jeffrey.
Yeah. Oh, Jeffrey. Can I tell you, in addition to us loving you, we all love Jeffrey.
Yeah.
He's pretty great, I have to say.
When he comes back from a business trip and he's coming back to like a perfect roast chicken, he's like the luckiest guy in the world.
Well, you don't know, is I'm high maintenance, so it's not all good. he has a very hard job.
Does he still, I mean, he's so used to this now, Ina, does he still look forward to different recipes and come home? Is he as happy as he seems on the show?
He really is. That's exactly who he is. He's just like the happiest guy I've ever met. He's just positive and upbeat, and he's just amazing. I mean, I've known him for more than 50 years, and I've never seen him have a bad day.
Wow.
To me, I'm like bouncing around. I'm high as a kite. I'm miserable. I'm everywhere. So we kind of balance each other nicely.
You two ever get in the car and go, screw it, we're going to McDonald's and hit the drive-thru?
I'm not so big on that. I actually like good food, even if it's really simple.
And I was harassed yesterday on the show for liking lentil soup. Can you explain to Steve specifically that lentil's a great soup and it's easy to make?
Any soup is, if you just sort of go through the steps of sauteing onions so they have lots of flavor and then you add all the ingredients, you put it on the stove on a low, you know, simmer and you just let it do its thing. I love good soup. We actually often make it like Sunday night dinner or soup.
You know, Ina, just for context purposes, I don't know how we got on this, but we were naming soups, and it was like, how many soups could you name?
Yeah.
And it was like chicken.
That's great.
It was chicken noodle, and the third one in the list from Mark was lentil.
Lentil.
I was going, how do you get lentil third? How is lentil third?
It's actually one of my favorite. I put pea soup and lentil. I love those too. I like that thickness of it. And Italian wedding soup's a good one too.
And her recipe is the easiest one, and it has so much flavor, even though it takes no time, which you usually can't get from broth. So I recommend you make it.
Absolutely.
Oh, that's great.
Hey, Ina, so tonight I'm going to be out in Rosemont. You're doing a show out there. What
oh,
can
you
we?
Will?
Yeah,
oh,
I'm going to be there.
Yes.
Can we come say hi? Oh no, my friends.
Come say hi.
Okay, good. I'll be the one waving. We were on the radio with you. No, what can we expect to see tonight? Will there be a little cooking demonstration? A little Q&A?
No, it's actually what we do is I with a friend of mine who's an incredible writer. Her name is Deborah Davis. She writes books like The Party of the Century and Strapless about John Singer Sargent. And she's a great interviewer. And so she always asks me surprising, we were in Milwaukee together last night, and she said to me, so tell me about your honeymoon. And I was like, nobody ever asked me about my honeymoon.
Well, it's a great question.
And, and we had it was a great question, and I actually had a really funny story about it. So you just never know. We talk about food, we talk about entertaining, we talk about, you know, business and Jeffrey, and it can be anything. And so we usually talk for about an hour, and then we open it up to audience questions.
Awesome.
And, you know, you just never know what people are going to ask. Deborah's favorite question of all time was somebody from the audience said, what's Jeffrey's favorite root vegetable?
Well, that's funny.
What is it?
How long did you think about it before you asked that?
Yeah.
I can't even remember. I have to say, it's the only time I've been stumped.
Oh, that's fantastic. Cooking for Jeffrey is your 10th cookbook, and the Food Network show has been on for 15 years now.
Isn't it crazy?
That?
We're going to film again on Monday. So still doing it.
And again, it's
so 7. Grateful that people still watch.
7:30 tonight. Tickets very reasonably priced too. So let's sell that out. 7:30 tonight at the Rosemont Theater, you can go and you can see Andrea be thrown out by security.
Oh, stop. I'm not going to. I think we're in the back. We'll be fine.
With the great Barefoot Contessa. By the way, I know you get asked this every single day, but why Barefoot Contessa?
Oh, you know, when I was in the White House and I saw this little ad for a business for sale in the New York Times, it was a store that had been going for about a year, and it was called the Barefoot Contessa. And I remember thinking, it's a terrible name for a food store because it's not like what it is or where it is or who it is. But I really didn't know anything about the business. So I thought, well, I'll just leave it for, you know, a year until I get myself on my feet and I figure out how to run a food store. It comes from a movie. It's with Ava Gardner and Humphrey Bogart. Oh. And it's when the woman who owned the store was Italian. And when she was a little girl, they used to call her the Barefoot Contessa. And after I'd run it for a little while, I thought, oh, it's actually a great name because it's about being elegant and earthy. And that's kind of where I see my...
Sums it up.
What I do. Yeah, kind of sums it up. So fortunately, I didn't drop the name. I kept it, and now I kind of love it.
Yeah, it kind of worked out for you. and the greatest cook I know, my mom says hello as well. So
see,
it's
everybody loves
say hi to your mom for me.
great to have you on the show. Ina Garten is the Barefoot Contessa.
To talk to both of you.
All right,
thanks, Steve.
Have a great time tonight.
Thanks,
it's
Ina.
Ina Garten, the Barefoot Contessa tonight at 7:30. I haven't seen you this excited
awesome?
About anything.
But don't you just love her?
She's very
she's
sweet.
So cool.
Very nice. Very nice.
You're going to make the coconut cake, aren't you?
I already did. I made it during that interview.
Can I?
Yes.
I'm sorry. There's an onion and fennel soup on here, Steve. And since you're an expert, I just want to ask you. It says a quarter cup of good olive oil. Like, can you go to the store?
Sure.
Bad olive oil?
Yeah.
Good olive oil? Is that how it works?
You get what you pay for when it comes to olive oil, my friend. Okay. Ask Popeye. Back in a moment on 720 WGN.
Live from the Allstate Showcase Studio, this is the Steve Cochran Show on Chicago's very own 720 WGN.
Well, that's good. This is the traditional Passover music we're going to play.
You want me to sing some?
Darkest of night with the moon shining bright.
When I'm walking into the temple, I'm usually playing this. Two of the funniest people in the world we know because we've done extensive testing. Dave Barry and Alan Zweibel join us on the phone, curiously, from the same hotel room in New York. Good morning, Dave.
Hey, Steve. How are you?
I'm doing just fine. Why are you guys in the same room?
Well, there's probably an instant explanation. Alan is in the closet, and I'm not. You know what I mean?
We noticed you used the word curiously, and hopefully that's an answer to that you just gave.
Alan, who's on the register down at the hotel where they give you the giant key?
You know something? Dave has every room for some reason. Every room that you ask for, Dave Barry has that one. I don't know why.
I don't doubt it. The book is called
I want you to know, though, that Alan comes with his own massage table.
He does.
It's a nice new clean. So Sears, it's beautiful. Anyway, go ahead. I'm sorry.
And hopefully a selection of fine oils. The book is called...
Oils. I don't know how fine they are.
The book is called For This, We Left Egypt. A Passover Haggadah for Jews and those who love them. You guys know the book's backwards, right?
Yeah, actually, you're supposed to read it. I want to stress this for those who are not of the Jewish persuasion. You got to read this book from starting at the back, what we would traditionally call it, back to the front. If you read it in the other direction, it's a story of how the Jews were free in Egypt, free in Israel, and ended up enslaved in Egypt. So you want to go in the right direction.
Yeah, that would be the wrong way to go.
For slavery. Hey, let's be slaves. It's that thing.
I got to tell you, I am so relieved because I thought maybe I got the Marshall's copy. You know, like I went and I got the one-off. all right, so educate the rest of us. What's with all the wandering in the desert before the Jews got to go to the Promised Land?
I want you to know that I actually I wrote the section of this, the Haggadah, where they're wandering in the desert, and I did a little calculating, which was this is roughly from memory now, but they wandered for 40 years, and I say if the average Israelite wanders, let's say 1,000 steps a day, they could easily, in 40 years, and I did the math, have wandered all the way to Norway. Instead, they were still in the desert after 40 years.
Here's the deal.
They were not wandering in a straight line. That's what it tells me.
No, the fact is, I mean, I went to Hebrew school a lot. We learned that if you took the route that they took, if you just went on a straight line, the way the crow flies, it takes 11 days. 11 days. They stretched it for 40 years. So I think Moses, if he needed anything, was a GPS, okay? Because this is silly.
Well, you make a great point. Were anybody in Moses' party wearing Fitbits?
Let's just say Moses, if he were to park in a modern Walmart parking lot, would never find his car again. Let's put it that way.
It's a valid point. All right, I have another question. What's with the Jews and all the food?
Well, I'll let Alan answer that because he is actually of the Jewish persuasion.
Yes. I'm of the Jewish persuasion, yes. And because we've been persecuted by all you other people out there, we like to eat like there's no tomorrow because sometimes there is no tomorrow. So we just stuff ourselves silly.
Yeah, except I just want to intersperse one thing here. And the Passover Seder, which is one of the more sacred meals in the Jewish faith, the main thing that you eat for about like 2 hours straight is matzah, which is not really so much a food as a construction material.
Although matzah ball soup is awesome.
Well, that's why it's soup. They gotta moisturize it.
Put some cheese in there.
Cheese? You got cheese in matzah?
Oh, sorry. Sorry, guys.
Wait a minute now.
What do you? You got ham too?
I'm Greek. I got to put cheese on everything.
Yeah. And
there's no cheese.
There's no cheese in matzo ball soup.
By the way, Alan, as you're describing this, and I don't want to overstate this, but it sounds like for a Jew, every supper is the last supper.
You want to know something? We always wear our hats and keep the door open, no matter what we're eating. We keep the motor running. Okay.
The book is called "For This We Left Egypt." The Seder. Explain the Seder, if one of you would.
Oh, the Seder. I'm not myself personally Jewish, but my wife Michelle Kaufman is Jewish, and we host many Seders.
By the way, Dave, do you call her Michelle Kaufman?
Where you don't actually eat anything for approximately 2 days, and then you eat. But you have to first go through a lot of ritual about various things. Sometimes it takes long. You order a pizza while you're going through the rituals. But it's a lengthy ceremonial meal is what it is.
And
that's
Alan,
exactly right.
And Alan, how does that play out in your world?
Well, you know, we have a big house. We invite 25 or 30 people. We all sit around the table. Every person gets a part to read of the Haggadah, which, you know, we have parodied here. And by the time the meal comes, the food is spoiled and it's cold, and nobody talks to us ever again. So it's really a really pleasant holiday.
The thing that I find over the Christian holidays is that it's very tough to get people to leave. It seems that the Seder encourages people to stay even longer.
Well, except that when it's actually over, people are so eager to get out of there and go get something. You know, let's go get a drink. Let's get something to eat.
Let's go to a fast food place.
Well, that'd be interesting if you opened a place, a Seder drive-through, huh?
There you go. Post-Seder drive-through, I think you can make a killing there. I really do. Because Seder food is very rarely eaten at that point of the Seder, the food-eating part. It's just basically pushed around on a plate, or if there were any kids under the table, it's fed to them.
And I don't want to make this all about Moses, but it seems like he did have a big influence. What's with the land of milk and honey? Was that a true story?
Well, I also address that issue. Like, basically, at one point, God appears to Moses and tells him that he's going to lead them to the promised land and they'll be flowing with milk and honey. And immediately, I mean, several questions would come to my mind. Are the milk and honey, like, flowing together? And are they on the ground? And wouldn't that attract insects? Is it really, would that be so funny? So, but you don't ask these questions when you're talking to a burning bush that's talking to in the voice of Morgan Freeman. So they do. They wander, as we said, they wandered basically in a space roughly the size of a gymnasium for 40 years, and then they finally get to the promised land, and there is no milk or honey. It's real. They're scorpions the size of Yorkshire Terriers, is what there are.
You know, when I went to
at that point, the Israelis were ready to turn around and go back to Egypt because their choice was to go back into slavery or deal with the vermin that they found in the Promised Land.
There's no question.
That's the dilemma my people had.
There's no question.
Look at that. When I went, I actually went to the Holy Land about 5-6 years ago with my mother. We did the trip through our church.
Did it feel like 40 years?
Well, it felt. You mean my trip with my mom? Yeah. No, it was cool. We saw the burning bush, or what they said was the burning bush, and someone It's not, but there is. I have a picture too. Somebody put a fire extinguisher. You know, obviously a tourist or one of the guards by what they say is the burning bush. There's a fire extinguisher next to the burning bush.
Funny Americans. You wonder why the rest of the world hates us.
Lightning. Yeah, somebody's going to wake up with a cold sore. I'm telling you.
Gentlemen, you've done great work here, and I feel like this is the type of thing in the age of Trump that can bring us together.
That's our role, Steve, as you know.
Hopefully.
Dave Barry, Alan Zweibel, and the missing Adam Monsbach. For this, we left Egypt. Out and available everywhere. Get two copies. You're careless. You lose the first one. And thank you, gentlemen. All the best.
All right, man.
See you later.
Thanks a million.
That's it.
You didn't ask about Elijah.
I love those guys. I love those guys.
Great.
They're very, very twisted. Yes. It says 9:53. We'll take a break, come back. More on CLTV and 720 WGN.